I'll be responsible. But how are we going to get the wrecking train out of here when there aren't any signals?
There will be signals in half an hour.
How?
Come on, she said, rising to her feet.
They followed her as she hurried down the passenger platforms, past the huddling, shifting groups of travelers by the motionless trains. She hurried down a narrow catwalk, through a maze of rail, past blinded signals and frozen switches, with nothing but the beat of her satin sandals to fill the great vaults of the underground tunnels of Taggart Transcontinental, with the hollow creaking of planks under the slower steps of men trailing her like a reluctant echo. She hurried to the lighted glass cube of Tower A that hung in the darkness like a crown without a body, the crown of a deposed ruler above a realm of empty tracks. The tower director was too expert a man at too exacting a job to be able wholly to conceal the dangerous burden of his intelligence. He understood what she wanted him to do from her first few words and answered only with an abrupt, "Yes, ma'am." But he was bent over his charts by the time the others came following her up the iron stairway. He was grimly at work on the most humiliating job of calculation he had ever had to perform in his long career. She knew how fully he understood it, from a single glance he threw at her, a glance of indignation and endurance that matched some emotion he had caught in her face. "We'll do it first and feel about it afterwards," she said, even though he had made no comment. "Yes, ma'am," he answered woodenly. His room, on the top of an underground tower, was like a glass veranda overlooking what had once been the swiftest, richest, and most orderly stream in the world. He had been trained to chart the course of over 90 trains an hour and to watch them roll safely through a maze of tracks and switches in and out of the terminal, under his glass walls and his fingertips. Now, for the first time, he was looking out at the empty darkness of a dried channel. Through the open door of the relay room, she saw the tower men standing grimly idle, the men whose jobs had never permitted a moment's relaxation, standing by the long rows that looked like vertical copper plates, like shelves of books and as much of a monument to human intelligence. The pull of one of the small levers, which protruded like bookmarks from the shelves, threw thousands of electric circuits into motion, made thousands of contacts and broke as many others, set dozens of switches to clear a chosen course and dozens of signals to light it, with no error left possible, no chance, no contradiction. An enormous complexity of thought condensed into one movement of a human hand to set and ensure the course of a train, that hundreds of trains might safely rush by, that thousands of tons of metal and lives might pass in speeding streaks a breath away from one another, protected by nothing but a thought, the thought of the man who devised the levers. But she looked at the face of her signal engineer. They believed that that muscular contraction of a hand was the only thing required to move the traffic. And now the tower men stood idle, and on the great panels in front of the tower director, the red and green lights, which had flashed announcing the progress of trains at a distance of miles, were now so many glass beads, like the glass beads for which another breed of savages had once sold the island of Manhattan.
"Call all of your unskilled laborers," she said to the assistant manager. "The section hands, track walkers, engine wipers, whoever's in the terminal right now, and have them come here at once."
"Here?"
"Here," she said, pointing at the tracks outside the tower. "Call all your switchmen, too. Phone your storehouse and have them bring here every lantern they can lay their hands on, any sort of lantern, conductor's lanterns, storm lanterns, anything."
"Lanterns, Miss Taggart?"
"Get going."
"Yes, ma'am."
"What is it we're doing, Miss Taggart?" asked the dispatcher.
"We're going to move trains, and we're going to move them manually."
"Manually?" said the signal engineer.
"Yes, brother. Now why should you be shocked?" She could not resist it. "Manny's only muscles, isn't he? We're going back. Back to where there were no interlocking systems, no semaphores, no electricity. Back to the time when train signals were not steel and wire, but men holding lanterns. Physical men, serving as lampposts. You've advocated it long enough. You got what you wanted.
Oh, you thought that your tools would determine your ideas? But it happens to be the other way around. And now you're going to see the kind of tools your ideas have determined. But even to go back took an act of intelligence, she thought, feeling the paradox of her own position as she looked at the lethargy of the faces around her. How will we work the switches, Miss Taggart?
By hand.
And the signals?
By hand.
How? By placing a man with a lantern at every signal post.
How?
There's not enough clearance.
We'll use alternate tracks.
How will the men know which way to throw the switches?
By written orders.
Huh?
By written orders, just as in the old days.
She pointed to the tower director.
He's working out a schedule of how to move the trains and which tracks to use. He'll write out an order for every signal and switch. He'll pick some men as runners, and they'll keep delivering the orders to every post. And it will take hours to do what used to take minutes, but we'll get those waiting trains into the terminal and out on the road.
We're to work it that way all night?
And all day tomorrow, until the engineer who's got the brains for it shows you how to repair the interlocker.
There's nothing in the union contracts about men standing with lanterns. There's going to be trouble. The union will object.
Let them come to me.
The unification board will object.
I'll be responsible.
Well, I wouldn't want to be held for giving the orders.
I'll give the orders.
She stepped out on the landing of the iron stairway that hung on the side of the tower. She was fighting for self-control. It seemed to her for a moment as if she too were a precision instrument of high technology, left without electric current, trying to run a transcontinental railroad by means of her two hands. She looked out at the great silent darkness of the Taggart Underground, and she felt a stab of burning humiliation that she should now see it brought down to the level where human lampposts would stand in its tunnels as its last memorial statues. She could barely distinguish the faces of the men when they gathered at the foot of the tower. They came streaming silently through the darkness and stood without moving in the bluish murk, with blue bulbs on the walls behind them and patches of light falling on their shoulders from the tower's windows. She could see the greasy garments, the slack muscular bodies, the limply hanging arms of men drained by the unrewarding exhaustion of a labor that required no thought. These were the dregs of the railroad, the younger men who could now seek no chance to rise, and the older men who had never wanted to seek it. They stood in silence, not with the apprehensive curiosity of workmen, but with the heavy indifference of convicts.
"The orders which you are about to receive have come from me," she said, standing above them on the iron stairs, speaking with resonant clarity. "The men who will issue them are acting under my instructions. The interlocking control system has broken down. It will now be replaced by human labor. Train service will be resumed at once." She noticed some faces in the crowd staring at her with a peculiar look, with a veiled resentment, and the kind of insolent curiosity that made her suddenly conscious of being a woman. Then she remembered what she wore, and thought that it did look preposterous. And then at the sudden stab of some violent impulse that felt like defiance, and like loyalty to the full, real meaning of the moment, she threw her cape back and stood in the raw glare of light, under the sooted columns, like a figure at a formal reception, sternly erect, flaunting the luxury of naked arms, of glowing black satin, of a diamond flashing like a military cross. The tower director will assign switchmen to their posts. He will select men for the job of signaling trains by means of lanterns and for the task of transmitting his orders. Trains will... She was fighting to drown a bitter voice that seemed to be saying, "That's all they're fit for, these men, if even that. There's not a single mind left anywhere on Taggart Transcontinental." "Trains will continue to be moved in and out of the terminal. You will remain at your posts until..." Then she stopped. It was his eyes and hair that she saw first, the ruthlessly perceptive eyes, the streaks of hair shaded from gold to copper that seemed to reflect the glow of sunlight in the murk of the underground. She saw John Galt among the chain gang of the mindless, John Galt in greasy overalls and rolled shirt sleeves. She saw his weightless way of standing, his face held lifted, his eyes looking at her as if he had seen this moment many moments ago.
"What's the matter, Miss Taggart?"
It was the soft voice of the tower director, who stood by her side with some sort of paper in his hand, and she thought it was strange to emerge from a span of unconsciousness which had been the span of the sharpest awareness she had ever experienced, only she did not know how long it had lasted, or where she was, or why. She had been aware of Galt's face. She had been seeing in the shape of his mouth, in the planes of his cheeks, the crack-up of that implacable serenity which had always been his. But he still retained it in his look of acknowledging the breach, of admitting that this moment was too much even for him. She knew that she went on speaking, because those around her looked as if they were listening, though she could not hear a sound. She went on speaking as if carrying out a hypnotic order given to herself some endless time ago, knowing only that the completion of that order was a form of defiance against him, neither knowing nor hearing her own words. She felt as if she were standing in a radiant silence where sight was her only capacity, and his face was its only object, and the sight of his face was like a speech in the form of a pressure at the base of her throat. It seemed so natural that he should be here. It seemed so unendurably simple. She felt as if the shock were not his presence, but the presence of others on the tracks of her railroad, where he belonged and they did not. She was seeing those moments aboard a train when, at its plunge into the tunnels, she had felt a sudden, solemn tension, as if this place were showing her in naked simplicity the essence of her railroad and of her life, the union of consciousness and matter, the frozen form of a mind's ingenuity giving physical existence to its purpose. She had felt a sense of sudden hope, as if this place held the meaning of all of her values, and a sense of secret excitement, as if a nameless promise were awaiting her under the ground. It was right that she should now meet him here. He had been the meaning and the promise. She was not seeing his clothing any longer, nor to what level her railroad had reduced him. She was seeing only the vanishing torture of the months when he had been outside her reach. She was seeing in his face the confession of what those months had cost him. The only speech she heard was as if she were saying to him, "This is the reward for all my days," and as if he were answering, "For all of mine." She knew that she had finished speaking to the strangers when she saw that the tower director had stepped forward and was saying something to them, glancing at a list in his hand. Then, drawn by a sense of irresistible certainty, she found herself descending the stairs, slipping away from the crowd, not toward the platforms and the exit, but into the darkness of the abandoned tunnels. "You will follow me," she thought, and felt as if the thought were not in words, but in the tension of her muscles, the tension of her will to accomplish a thing she knew to be outside her power, yet she knew with certainty that it would be accomplished, and by her wish. No, she thought, not by her wish, but by its total rightness. "You will follow me." It was neither plea nor prayer nor demand, but the quiet statement of a fact. It contained the whole of her power of knowledge and the whole of the knowledge she had earned through the years. "You will follow me, if we are what we are, you and I, if we live, if the world exists. If you know the meaning of this moment and can't let it slip by, as others let it slip, into the senselessness of the unwilled and unreached, you will follow me." She felt an exultant assurance which was neither hope nor faith, but an act of worship for the logic of existence. She was hurrying down the remnants of abandoned rails, down the long dark corridors twisting through granite. She lost the sound of the director's voice behind her. Then she felt the beat of her arteries and heard, in answering rhythm, the beat of the city above her head. But she felt as if she heard the motion of her blood as a sound filling the silence, and the motion of the city as the beat inside her body. And far behind her, she heard the sound of steps. She did not glance back. She went faster.
She went past the locked iron door where the remnant of his motor was still hidden. She did not stop, but a faint shudder was her answer to the sudden glimpse of the unity and logic in the events of the last 2 years. A string of blue lights went on into the darkness, over patches of glistening granite, over broken sandbags spilling drifts on the rails, over rusty piles of scrap metal. When she heard the steps coming closer, she stopped and turned to look back. She saw a sweep of blue light flash briefly on the shining strands of Galt's hair. She caught the pale outline of his face and the dark hollows of his eyes. The face disappeared, but the sound of his steps served as the link to the next blue light that swept across the line of his eyes, the eyes that remained held level, directed ahead. And she felt certain that she had stayed in his sight from the moment he had seen her at the tower. She heard the beat of the city above them. These tunnels, she had once thought, were the roots of the city and of all the motion reaching to the sky. But they, she thought, John Galt and she, were the living power within these roots. They were the start and aim and meaning. He too, she thought, heard the beat of the city as the beat of his body. She threw her cape back. She stood defiantly straight as he had seen her stand on the steps of the tower, as he had seen her for the first time 10 years ago here, under the ground. She was hearing the words of his confession, not as words, but by means of that beating which made it so difficult to breathe. You looked like a symbol of luxury, and you belonged in the place that was its source. You seemed to bring the enjoyment of life back to its rightful owners. You had a look of energy and of its reward together. And I was the first man who had ever stated in what manner these two were inseparable. The next span of moments was like flashes of light in stretches of blinded unconsciousness. The moment when she saw his face, as he stopped beside her, when she saw the unastonished calm, the leashed intensity, the laughter of understanding in the dark green eyes, the moment when she knew what he saw in her face by the tight-drawn harshness of his lips, the moment when she felt his mouth on hers, when she felt the shape of his mouth both as an absolute shape and as a liquid filling her body, then the motion of his lips down the line of her throat, a drinking motion that left a trail of bruises, than the sparkle of her diamond clip against the trembling copper of his hair. Then she was conscious of nothing but the sensations of her body, because her body acquired the sudden power to let her know her most complex values by direct perception. Just as her eyes had the power to translate wavelengths of energy into sight, just as her ears had the power to translate vibrations into sound, so her body now had the power to translate the energy that had moved all the choices of her life into immediate sensory perception. It was not the pressure of a hand that made her tremble, but the instantaneous sum of its meaning, the knowledge that it was his hand, that it moved as if her flesh were his possession, that its movement was his signature of acceptance under the whole of that achievement which was herself. It was only a sensation of physical pleasure, but it contained her worship of him, of everything that was his person and his life. From the night of the mass meeting in a factory in Wisconsin, to the Atlantis of a valley hidden in the Rocky Mountains, to the triumphant mockery of the green eyes of the superlative intelligence above a worker's figure at the foot of the tower, it contained her pride in herself, and that it should be she whom he had chosen as his mirror, that it should be her body which was now giving him the sum of his existence, as his body was giving her the sum of hers. These were the things it contained, but what she knew was only the sensation of the movement of his hand on her breasts. He tore off her cape, and she felt the slenderness of her own body by means of the circle of his arms, as if his person were only a tool for her triumphant awareness of herself, but that self were only a tool for her awareness of him. It was as if she were reaching the limit of her capacity to feel. Yet what she felt was like a cry of impatient demand, which she was now incapable of naming, except that it had the same quality of ambition as the course of her life, the same inexhaustible quality of radiant greed. He pulled her head back for a moment, to look straight into her eyes, to let her see his, to let her know the full meaning of their actions, as if throwing the spotlight of consciousness upon them for the meeting of their eyes in a moment of intimacy greater than the one to come. Then she felt the mesh of burlap striking the skin of her shoulders. She found herself lying on the broken sandbags. She saw the long, tight gleam of her stockings. She felt his mouth pressed to her ankle, then rising in a tortured motion up the line of her leg, as if he wished to own its shape by means of his lips. Then she felt her teeth sinking into the flesh of his arm. She felt the sweep of his elbow knocking her head aside, and his mouth seizing her lips with a pressure more viciously painful than hers. Then she felt, when it hit her throat, that which she knew only as an upward streak of motion that released and united her body into a single shock of pleasure. Then she knew nothing but the motion of his body and the driving greed that went reaching on and on, as if she were not a person any longer, only a sensation of endless reaching for the impossible. Then she knew that it was possible, and she gasped and lay still, knowing that nothing more could be desired, ever. He lay beside her on his back, looking up at the darkness of the granite vault above them. She saw him stretched on the jagged slant of sandbags as if his body were fluid in relaxation. She saw the black wedge of her cape flung across the rails at their feet. There were beads of moisture twinkling on the vault, shifting slowly, running into invisible cracks like the lights of a distant traffic. When he spoke, his voice sounded as if he were quietly continuing a sentence in answer to the questions in her mind, as if he had nothing to hide from her any longer, and what he owed her now was only the act of undressing his soul, as simply as he would have undressed his body. "This is how I've watched you for 10 years. From here, from under the ground, under your feet. Knowing every move you made in your office at the top of the building, but never seeing you, never enough. 10 years of nights spent waiting to catch a glimpse of you here, on the platforms, when you boarded a train. Whenever the order came down to couple your car, I'd know of it and wait and see you come down the ramp and wish you didn't walk so fast. It was so much like you, that walk. I'd know it anywhere. Your walk and those legs of yours. It was always your legs that I'd see first, hurrying down the ramp, going past me as I looked up at you from a dark side track below. I think I could have molded a sculpture of your legs. I knew them, not with my eyes, but with the palms of my hands when I watched you go by, when I turned back to my work, when I went home just before sunrise for the 3 hours of sleep which I didn't get. I love you, she said, her voice quiet and almost toneless except for a fragile sound of youth. He closed his eyes as if letting the sound travel through the years behind them. 10 years, Dagny. Except that once there were a few weeks when I had you before me, in plain sight, within reach, not hurrying away, but held still, as on a lighted stage, a private stage for me to watch. And I watched you for hours through many evenings, in the lighted window of an office that was called the John Galt Line. And one night, her breath was a faint gasp.
Was it you that night?
Did you see me?
I saw your shadow, on the pavement, pacing back and forth. It looked like a struggle. It looked like...
She stopped. She did not want to say torture. It was, he said quietly. That night I wanted to walk in, to face you, to speak, to... That was the night I came closest to breaking my oath, when I saw you slumped across your desk, when I saw you broken by the burden you were carrying.
John, that night, it was you that I was thinking of. Only I didn't know it.
But you see, I knew it.
It was you all my life, through everything I did and everything I wanted.
I know it.
John, the hardest was not when I left you in the valley. It was...
Your radio speech,
the day you returned?
Yes. Were you listening?
Of course. I'm glad you did it. It was a magnificent thing to do. And I knew it anyway.
You knew? About Hank Reardon?
Before I saw you in the valley.
Was it... When you learned about him, had you expected it?
No.
Was it...
She stopped. Hard? Yes. But only for the first few days. That next night. Do you want me to tell you what I did the night after I learned it?
Yes.
I had never seen Hank Reardon, only pictures of him in the newspapers. I knew that he was in New York that night, at some conference of big industrialists. I wanted to have just one look at him. I went to wait at the entrance of the hotel where that conference was held. There were bright lights under the marquee of the entrance, but it was dark beyond on the pavement, so I could see without being seen. There were a few loafers and vagrants hanging around. There was a drizzle of rain, and we clung to the walls of the building. One could tell the members of the conference when they began filing out, by their clothes and their manner. Ostentatiously prosperous clothes and a manner of overbearing timidity, as if they were guiltily trying to pretend that they were what they appeared to be for that moment. There were chauffeurs driving up their cars. There were a few reporters delaying them for questions, and hangers-on trying to catch a word from them. They were worn men, those industrialists, aging, flabby, frantic with the effort to disguise uncertainty. And then I saw him. He wore an expensive trench coat and a hat slanting across his eyes. He walked swiftly, with a kind of assurance that has to be earned, as he'd earned it. Some of his fellow industrialists pounced on him with questions, and those tycoons were acting like hangers-on around him. I caught a glimpse of him as he stood with his hand on the door of his car, his head lifted. I saw the brief flare of a smile under the slanting brim, a confident smile, impatient and a little amused. And then for one instant, I did what I had never done before, what most men wreck their lives on doing. I saw that moment out of context. I saw the world as he made it look, as if it matched him, as if he were its symbol. I saw a world of achievement, of unenslaved energy, of unobstructed drive through purposeful years to the enjoyment of one's reward. I saw, as I stood in the rain in a crowd of vagrants, what my years would have brought me if that world had existed, and I felt a desperate longing. He was the image of everything I should have been, and he had everything that should have been mine. But it was only a moment. Then I saw the scene in full context again, and in all of its actual meaning. I saw what price he was paying for his brilliant ability, what torture he was enduring in silent bewilderment, struggling to understand what I had understood. I saw that the world he suggested did not exist and was yet to be made. I saw him again for what he was, the symbol of my battle, the unrewarded hero whom I was to avenge and to release. And then I accepted what I had learned about you and him. I saw that it changed nothing, that I should have expected it, that it was right. He heard the faint sound of her moan, and he chuckled softly. Dagny, it's not that I don't suffer. It's that I know the unimportance of suffering. I know that pain is to be fought and thrown aside, not to be accepted as part of one's soul and as a permanent scar across one's view of existence. Don't feel sorry for me. It was gone right then. She turned her head to look at him in silence, and he smiled, lifting himself on an elbow to look down at her face as she lay helplessly still. She whispered, "You've been a track laborer here, for 12 years. "Yes."
"Ever since?"
"Ever since I quit the 20th century."
The night when you saw me for the first time. You were working here then?
Yes. And the morning when you offered to work for me as my cook, I was only your track laborer on leave of absence. Do you see why I laughed as I did?
She was looking up at his face. Hers was a smile of pain, his of pure gaiety.
John.
Say it, but say it all.
You were here, all those years.
Yes.
All those years, while the railroad was perishing, while I was searching for men of intelligence, while I was struggling to hold on to any scrap of it I could find,
while you were combing the country for the inventor of my motor, while you were feeding James Taggart and Wesley Mouch, while you were naming your best achievement after the enemy whom you wanted to destroy.
She closed her eyes.
I was here all those years, he said, within your reach, inside your own realm, watching your struggle, your loneliness, your longing, watching you in a battle you thought you were fighting for me, a battle in which you were supporting my enemies and taking an endless defeat. I was here, hidden by nothing but an error of your sight, as Atlantis is hidden from men by nothing but an optical illusion. I was here, waiting for the day when you would see, when you would know that by the code of the world you were supporting, it's to the darkest bottom of the underground that all the things you valued would have to be consigned, and that it's there that you would have to look. I was here. I was waiting for you. I love you, Dagny. I love you more than my life. I who have taught men how life is to be loved. I've taught them also never to expect the unpaid for. And what I did tonight, I did it with full knowledge that I would pay for it and that my life might have to be the price.
No,
he smiled, nodding. Oh, yes. You know that you've broken me for once. That I broke the decision I had set for myself. But I did it consciously, knowing what it meant. I did it, not in blind surrender to the moment, but with full sight of the consequences and full willingness to bear them. I could not let this kind of moment pass us by. It was ours, my love. We had earned it. But you're not ready to quit and join me. You don't have to tell me, I know. And since I chose to take what I wanted before it was fully mine, I'll have to pay for it. I have no way of knowing how or when. I know only that if I give in to an enemy, I'll take the consequences. He smiled in answer to the look on her face. No, Dagny, you're not my enemy in mind. And that is what brought me to this. But you are, in fact, in the course you're pursuing, though you don't see it yet, but I do. My actual enemies are of no danger to me. You are. You're the only one who can lead them to find me. They would never have the capacity to know what I am. But with your help, they will.
No.
No, not by your intention. And you're free to change your course. But so long as you follow it, you're not free to escape its logic. Don't frown. The choice was mine, and it's a danger I chose to accept. I am a traitor, Dagny, in all things. I wanted you. I had no power to change your decision. I had only the power to consider the price and decide whether I could afford it. I could. My life is mine to spend or to invest. And you, you're... As if his gesture were continuing his sentence, he raised her across his arm and kissed her mouth, while her body hung limply in surrender, her hair streaming down, her head falling back, held only by the pressure of his lips. You're the one reward I had to have and chose to buy. I wanted you, and if my life is the price, I'll give it. My life, but not my mind. There was a sudden glint of hardness in his eyes as he sat up and smiled and asked, Would you want me to join you and go to work?
Would you like me to repair that interlocking signal system of yours within an hour?
No.
The cry was immediate, in answer to the flash of a sudden image, the image of the men in the private dining room of the Wayne Falkland. He laughed.
Why not?
I don't want to see you working as their serf.
And yourself?
I think that they're crumbling and that I'll win. I can stand it just a little longer.
True. It's just a little longer. Not till you win, but till you learn.
I can't let it go.
It was a cry of despair. Not yet, he said quietly. He got up and she rose obediently, unable to speak.
I will remain here on my job, he said. But don't try to see me. You'll have to endure what I've endured and wanted to spare you. You'll have to go on, knowing where I am, wanting me as I'll want you, but never permitting yourself to approach me. Don't seek me here. Don't come to my home. Don't ever let them see us together. And when you reach the end, when you're ready to quit, don't tell them. Just chalk a dollar sign on the pedestal of Nat Taggart's statue, where it belongs. Then go home and wait. I'll come for you in 24 hours.
She inclined her head in silent promise. But when he turned to go, a sudden shudder ran through her body, like a first jolt of awakening or a last convulsion of life, and it ended in an involuntary cry.
Where are you going?
To be a lamppost and stand holding a lantern till dawn, which is the only work your world relegates me to, and the only work it's going to get.
She seized his arm to hold him, to follow him blindly, abandoning everything but the sight of his face.
John!
He gripped her wrist, twisted her hand, and threw it off.
No, he said.
Then he took her hand and raised it to his lips, and the pressure of his mouth was more passionate a statement than any he had chosen to confess. Then he walked away, down the vanishing line of rail, and it seemed to her that both the rail and the figure were abandoning her at the same time. When she staggered out into the concourse of the terminal, the first blast of rolling wheels went shuddering through the walls of the building, like the sudden beat of a heart that had stopped. The temple of Nathaniel Taggart was silent and empty, its changeless light beating down on a deserted stretch of marble. Some shabby figures shuffled across it, as if lost in its shining expanse. On the steps of the pedestal, under the statue of the austere, exultant figure, a ragged bum sat slumped in passive resignation, like a wing-plucked bird with no place to go, resting on any chance cornice. She fell down on the steps of the pedestal, like another derelict, her dust-smeared cape wrapped tightly about her. She sat still, her head on her arm, past crying, or feeling, or moving. It seemed to her only that she kept seeing a figure with a raised arm holding a light, and it looked at times like the Statue of Liberty, and then it looked like a man with sun-streaked hair holding a lantern against a midnight sky, a red lantern that stopped the movement of the world.
"Don't take it to heart, lady, whatever it is," said the bum, in a tone of exhausted compassion. "Nothing's to be done about it anyway. What's the use, lady? Who is John Galt?"
Chapter 6. The Concerto of Deliverance. On October 20th, the Steelworkers' Union of Reardon Steel demanded a raise in wages. Hank Reardon learned it from the newspapers. No demand had been presented to him, and it had not been considered necessary to inform him. The demand was made to the Unification Board. It was not explained why no other steel company was presented with a similar claim. He was unable to tell whether the demanders did or did not represent his workers, the board's rules on union elections having made it a matter impossible to define. He learned only that the group consisted of those newcomers whom the board had slipped into his mills in the past few months. On October 23rd, the Unification Board rejected the union's petition, refusing to grant the raise. If any hearings had been held on the matter, Reardon had not known about it. He had not been consulted, informed, or notified.
He had waited, volunteering, no questions. On October 25th, the newspapers of the country, controlled by the same men who controlled the board, began a campaign of commiseration with the workers of Reardon Steel. They printed stories about the refusal of the wage raise, omitting any mention of who had refused it or who held the exclusive legal power to refuse, as if counting on the public to forget legal technicalities under a barrage of stories implying that an employer was the natural cause of all miseries suffered by employees. They printed a story describing the hardships of the workers of Reardon Steel under the present rise in the cost of their living, next to a story describing Hank Reardon's profits of 5 years ago. They printed a story on the plight of a Reardon worker's wife trudging from store to store in a hopeless quest for food, next to a story about a champagne bottle broken over somebody's head at a drunken party given by an unnamed steel tycoon at a fashionable hotel. The steel tycoon had been Orrin Boyle, but the story mentioned no names. Inequalities still exist among us, the newspapers were saying, and cheat us of the benefits of our enlightened age. Privations have worn the nerves and temper of the people. The situation is reaching the danger point. We fear an outbreak of violence. We fear an outbreak of violence, the newspapers kept repeating. On October 28th, a group of the new workers at Reardon Steel attacked a foreman and knocked the tuyeres off a blast furnace. 2 days later, a similar group broke the ground floor windows of the administration building. A new worker smashed the gears of a crane, upsetting a ladle of molten metal within a yard of 5 bystanders. "Guess I went nuts, worrying about my hungry kids," he said when arrested. "This is no time to theorize about who's right or wrong," the newspapers commented. "Our sole concern is the fact that an inflammatory situation is endangering the steel output of the country." Reardon watched, asking no questions. He waited, as if some final knowledge were in the process of unraveling before him, a process not to be hastened or stopped. No, he thought through the early dusk of autumn evenings, looking out the window of his office. No, he was not indifferent to his mills. But the feeling which had once been passion for a living entity was now like the wistful tenderness one feels for the memory of the loved and dead. The special quality of what one feels for the dead, he thought, is that no action is possible any longer. On the morning of October 31st, he received a notice informing him that all of his property, including his bank accounts and safety deposit boxes, had been attached to satisfy a delinquent judgment obtained against him in a trial involving a deficiency in his personal income tax of 3 years ago. It was a formal notice, complying with every requirement of the law, except that no such deficiency had ever existed, and no such trial had ever taken place. "No," he said to his indignation-choked attorney. "Don't question them. Don't answer. Don't object."
"But this is fantastic."
"Any more fantastic than the rest?"
"Hank, do you want me to do nothing? To take it lying down?"
"No, standing up. And I mean standing. Don't move. Don't act."
"But they've left you helpless."
"Have they?" he asked softly, smiling. He had a few $100 in cash left in his wallet, nothing else. But the odd glowing warmth in his mind, like the feel of a distant handshake, was the thought that in a secret safe of his bedroom there lay a bar of solid gold, given to him by a gold-haired pirate. Next day, on November 1st, he received a telephone call from Washington, from a bureaucrat whose voice seemed to come sliding down the wire on its knees in protestations of apology.
"A mistake, Mr. Reardon. It was nothing but an unfortunate mistake. That attachment was not intended for you. You know how it is nowadays, with the inefficiency of all office help and with the amount of red tape we're tangled in, some bungling fool mixed the records and processed the attachment order against you, when it wasn't your case at all. It was, in fact, the case of a soap manufacturer. Please accept our apologies, Mr. Reardon, our deepest personal apologies at the top level."
The voice slid to a slight, expectant pause.
Mr. Reardon?
I'm listening.
I can't tell you how sorry we are to have caused you any embarrassment or inconvenience. And with all those damn formalities that we have to go through, you know how it is, red tape? It will take a few days, perhaps a week, to deprocess that order and to lift the attachment. Mr. Reardon?
I heard you.
We're desperately sorry and ready to make any amends within our power. You will, of course, be entitled to claim damages for any inconvenience this might cause you, and we are prepared to pay. We won't contest it. You will, of course, file such a claim, and...
I have not said that.
No, you haven't. That is... Well, what have you said, Mr. Reardon?
I have said nothing. Late on the next afternoon, another voice came pleading from Washington. This one did not seem to slide, but to bounce on the telephone wire with the gay virtuosity of a tightrope walker. It introduced itself as Tinky Holloway and pleaded that Reardon attend a conference, an informal little conference, just a few of us, the top-level few, to be held in New York at the Wayne Falkland Hotel day after next. There have been so many misunderstandings in the past few weeks, said Tinky Holloway. Such unfortunate misunderstandings, and so unnecessary. We could straighten everything out in a jiffy, Mr. Reardon, if we had a chance to have a little talk with you. We're extremely anxious to see you.
You can issue a subpoena for me any time you wish.
Oh, no, no, no! The voice sounded frightened. No, Mr. Reardon. Why think of such things? You don't understand us. We're anxious to meet you on a friendly basis. We're seeking nothing but your voluntary cooperation.
Holloway paused tensely, wondering whether he had heard the faint sound of a distant chuckle. He waited, but heard nothing else.
Mr. Reardon?
Yes.
Surely, Mr. Reardon, at a time like this, a conference with us could be to your great advantage.
A conference? About what?
You've encountered so many difficulties, and we're anxious to help you in any way we can.
I have not asked for help.
These are precarious times, Mr. Reardon. The public mood is so uncertain and inflammatory, so dangerous, and we want to be able to protect you.
I have not asked for protection.
But surely you realize that we're in a position to be of value to you, and if there's anything you want from us, any...
There isn't.
But you must have problems you'd like to discuss with us.
I haven't.
Then... Well, then...
Giving up the attempt at the play of granting a favor, Holloway switched to an open plea.
Then won't you just give us a hearing?
If you have anything to say to me.
We have, Mr. Reardon, we certainly have. That's all we're asking for, a hearing. Just give us a chance. Just come to this conference. You wouldn't be committing yourself to anything.
He said it involuntarily and stopped, hearing a bright, mocking stab of life in Reardon's voice, an unpromising sound, as Reardon answered, I know it.
Well, I mean... That is... Well, then, will you come?
All right, said Reardon. I'll come. He did not listen to Holloway's assurances of gratitude. He noted only that Holloway kept repeating, At 7 p.m. November 4th, Mr. Reardon. November 4th! As if the date had some special significance. Reardon dropped the receiver and lay back in his chair, looking at the glow of furnace flames on the ceiling of his office. He knew that the conference was a trap. He knew also that he was walking into it with nothing for any trappers to gain. Tinky Holloway dropped the receiver in his Washington office and sat up tensely, frowning. Claude Slagenhop, president of Friends of Global Progress, who had sat in an armchair nervously chewing a matchstick, glanced up at him and asked, Not so good? Holloway shook his head. He'll come, but... No, not so good.
He added, I don't think he'll take it. That's what my punk told me. I know. The punk said we'd better not try it.
God damn your punk. We've got to. We'll have to risk it.
The punk was Philip Reardon, who, weeks ago, had reported to Claude Slagenhop.
No, he won't let me in. He won't give me a job. I've tried as he wanted me to. I've tried my best, but it's no use. He won't let me set foot inside his mills. And as to his frame of mind, listen, it's bad. It's worse than anything I expected. I know him, and I can tell you that you won't have a chance. He's pretty much at the end of his rope. One more squeeze will snap it. You said the big boys wanted to know. Tell them not to do it. Tell them he... Claude, God help us if they do it. They'll lose him.
Well, you're not of much help, Slagenhop had said dryly, turning away. Philip had seized his sleeve and asked, his voice shrinking suddenly into open anxiety.
Say, Claude, according to Directive 10-289, if he goes, there's to be no heirs?
That's right.
They'd seize the mills and everything?
That's the law.
But, Claude, they wouldn't do that to me, would they?
They don't want him to go. You know that. Hold him if you can.
But I can't. You know I can't. Because of my political ideas and everything I've done for you, you know what he thinks of me. I have no hold on him at all.
Well, that's your tough luck.
Claude, Philip had cried in panic. Claude, they won't leave me out in the cold, will they? I belong, don't I? They've always said I belonged. They've always said they needed me. They said they needed men like me, not like him. Men with my sort of spirit, remember? And after all I've done for them, after all my faith and service and loyalty to the cause?
You damn fool, Slagenhop had snapped. Of what use are you to us without him? On the morning of November 4th, Hank Reardon was awakened by the ringing of the telephone. He opened his eyes to the sight of a clear, pale sky, the sky of early dawn in the window of his bedroom, a sky the delicate color of aquamarine, with the first rays of an invisible sun giving a shade of porcelain pink to Philadelphia's ancient rooftops. For a moment, while his consciousness had a purity to equal the skies, while he was aware of nothing but himself and had not yet re-harnessed his soul to the burden of alien memories, he lay still, held by the sight and by the enchantment of a world to match it, a world where the style of existence would be a continuous morning. The telephone threw him back into exile. It was screaming at spaced intervals, like a nagging, chronic cry for help, the kind of cry that did not belong in his world. He lifted the receiver, frowning. Hello?
Good morning, Henry, said a quavering voice. It was his mother.
Mother? At this hour? He asked dryly.
Oh, you're always up at dawn, and I wanted to catch you before you went to the office.
Yes? What is it?
I've got to see you, Henry. I've got to speak to you. Today. Sometime today. It's important.
Has anything happened?
No. Yes. That is... I've got to have a talk with you in person. Will you come?
I'm sorry, I can't. I have an appointment in New York tonight. If you want me to come tomorrow...
No. No, not tomorrow. It's got to be today. It's got to.
There was a dim tone of panic in her voice, but it was the stale panic of chronic helplessness, not the sound of an emergency, except for an odd echo of fear in her mechanical insistence. What is it, Mother?
I can't talk about it over the telephone. I've got to see you.
Then if you wish to come to the office...
No, not at the office. I've got to see you alone, where we can talk. Can't you come here today, as a favor? It's your mother who's asking you a favor.
You've never come to see us at all. And maybe you're not the one to blame for it either. But can't you do it for me this once, if I beg you to?
All right, Mother. I'll be there at 4 o'clock this afternoon.
That will be fine, Henry. Thank you, Henry. That will be fine.
It seemed to him that there was a touch of tension in the air of the Mills that day. It was a touch too slight to define, but the Mills, to him, were like the face of a loved wife, where he could catch shades of feeling almost ahead of expression. He noticed small clusters of the new workers, just 3 or 4 of them huddling together in conversation, once or twice too often. He noticed their manner, a manner suggesting a pool room corner, not a factory. He noticed a few glances thrown at him as he went by, glances a shade too pointed and lingering. He dismissed it. It was not quite enough to wonder about, and he had no time to wonder. When he drove up to his former home that afternoon, he stopped his car abruptly at the foot of the hill. He had not seen the house since that May 15th, 6 months ago, when he had walked out of it, and the sight brought back to him the sum of all he had felt in 10 years of daily homecoming. The strain, the bewilderment, the gray weight of unconfessed unhappiness, the stern endurance that forbade him to confess it, the desperate innocence of the effort to understand his family, the effort to be just. He walked slowly up the path toward the door. He felt no emotion, only the sense of a great, solemn clarity. He knew that this house was a monument of guilt, of his guilt toward himself. He had expected to see his mother and Philip. He had not expected the third person who rose, as they did, at his entrance into the living room. It was Lillian. He stopped on the threshold. They stood looking at his face and at the open door behind him. Their faces had a look of fear and cunning, the look of that blackmail through virtue which he had learned to understand, as if they hoped to get away with it by means of nothing but his pity, to hold him trapped when a single step back could take him out of their reach. They had counted on his pity and dreaded his anger. They had not dared consider the third alternative, his indifference. "What is she doing here?" he asked, turning to his mother, his voice dispassionately flat.
"Lillian's been living here ever since your divorce," she answered defensively. "I couldn't let her starve on the city pavements, could I?"
The look in his mother's eyes was half plea, as if she were begging him not to slap her face, half triumph, as if she had slapped his. He knew her motive. It was not compassion. There had never been much love between Lillian and her. It was their common revenge against him. It was the secret satisfaction of spending his money on the ex-wife he had refused to support. Lillian's head was poised to bow in greeting, with the tentative hint of a smile on her lips, half timid, half brash. He did not pretend to ignore her. He looked at her, as if he were seeing her fully, yet as if no presence were being registered in his mind. He said nothing, closed the door, and stepped into the room. His mother gave a small sigh of uneasy relief and dropped hastily into the nearest chair, watching him, nervously uncertain of whether he would follow her example. "What was it you wanted?" he asked, sitting down. His mother sat erect and oddly hunched, her shoulders raised, her head half lowered.
"Mercy, Henry," she whispered.
"What do you mean?"
"Don't you understand me?"
"No."
"Well?"
She spread her hands in an untidily fluttering gesture of helplessness.
"Well?"
Her eyes darted about, struggling to escape his attentive glance.
"Well, there are so many things to say, and I don't know how to say them, but... Well, there's one practical matter, but it's not important by itself. It's not why I called you here."
"What is it?"
"The practical matter? Our allowance checks. Philip's and mine. It's the first of the month, but on account of that attachment order, the checks couldn't come through. You know that, don't you?"
"I know it."
"Well, what are we going to do?"
I don't know.
I mean, what are you going to do about it?
Nothing. His mother sat staring at him, as if counting the seconds of silence.
Nothing, Henry?
I have no power to do anything. They were watching his face with a kind of searching intensity. He felt certain that his mother had told him the truth, that immediate financial worry was not their purpose, that it was only the symbol of a much wider issue.
But Henry, we are caught short.
So was I.
But can't you send us some cash or something?
They gave me no warning. No time to get any cash.
Then, look, Henry, the thing was so unexpected it scared people, I guess. The grocery store refuses to give us credit unless you ask for it. I think they want you to sign a credit card or something. So will you speak to them and arrange it?
I will not.
You won't?
She choked on a small gasp.
Why?
I will not assume obligations that I can't fulfill.
What do you mean?
I will not assume debts I have no way of repaying.
What do you mean, no way? That attachment is only some sort of technicality. It's only temporary. Everybody knows that.
Do they? I don't.
But Henry, a grocery bill. You're not sure you'll be able to pay a grocery bill? You? With all the millions you own?
I'm not going to defraud the grocer by pretending that I own those millions.
What are you talking about? Who owns them?
Nobody.
What do you mean?
Mother, I think you understand me fully. I think you understood it before I did. There isn't any ownership left in existence, or any property. It's what you've approved of and believed in for years. You wanted me tied. I'm tied. Now it's too late to play any games about it.
Are you going to let some political ideas of yours?
She saw the look on his face and stopped abruptly. Lillian sat looking down at the floor, as if afraid to glance up at this moment. Philip sat cracking his knuckles. His mother dragged her eyes into focus again and whispered,
"Don't abandon us, Henry."
Some faint stab of life in her voice told him that the lid of her real purpose was cracking open.
"These are terrible times, and we're scared." "That's the truth of it, Henry. We're scared, because you're turning away from us." "Oh, I don't mean just that grocery bill, but that's a sign. A year ago, you wouldn't have let that happen to us. Now? Now you don't care."
She made an expectant pause.
"Do you?"
"No."
Well, I guess the blame is ours. That's what I wanted to tell you. That we know we're to blame. We haven't treated you right all these years. We've been unfair to you. We've made you suffer. We've used you and given you no thanks in return. We're guilty, Henry. We've sinned against you, and we confess it. What more can we say to you now? Will you find it in your heart to forgive us?
"What is it you want me to do?" he asked, in the clear, flat tone of a business conference.
"I don't know. Who am I to know? But that's not what I'm talking of right now. Not of doing, only of feeling. It's your feeling that I'm begging you for, Henry. Just your feeling. Even if we don't deserve it. You're generous and strong. Will you cancel the past, Henry? Will you forgive us?"
The look of terror in her eyes was real. A year ago, he would have told himself that this was her way of making amends. He would have choked his revulsion against her words, words which conveyed nothing to him but the fog of the meaningless. He would have violated his mind to give them meaning, even if he did not understand. He would have ascribed to her the virtue of sincerity in her own terms, even if they were not his. But he was through with granting respect to any terms other than his own.
"Will you forgive us?"
"Mother,
It would be best not to speak of that. Don't press me to tell you why. I think you know it as well as I do. If there's anything you want done, tell me what it is. There's nothing else to discuss.
But I don't understand you. I don't. That's what I called you here for, to ask your forgiveness. Are you going to refuse to answer me?
Very well. What would it mean, my forgiveness?
Huh?
I said, what would it mean? She spread her hands out in an astonished gesture to indicate the self-evident.
Why, it would make us feel better.
Will it change the past?
It would make us feel better to know that you've forgiven it.
Do you wish me to pretend that the past has not existed?
Oh, God, Henry, can't you see? All we want is only to know that you feel some concern for us.
I don't feel it. Do you wish me to fake it?
But that's what I'm begging you for, to feel it.
On what ground?
Ground?
In exchange for what?
Henry, it's not business we're talking about, not steel tonnages and bank balances, it's feelings. And you talk like a traitor.
I am one. What he saw in her eyes was terror. Not the helpless terror of struggling and failing to understand, but the terror of being pushed toward the edge where to avoid understanding would no longer be possible.
Look, Henry, said Philip hastily. Mother can't understand those things. We don't know how to approach you. We can't speak your language.
I don't speak yours.
What she's trying to say is that we're sorry. We're terribly sorry that we've hurt you. You think we're not paying for it, but we are. We're suffering remorse.
The pain in Philip's face was real. A year ago, Reardon would have felt pity. Now he knew that they had held him through nothing but his reluctance to hurt them, his fear of their pain. He was not afraid of it any longer.
We're sorry, Henry. We know we've harmed you. We wish we could atone for it. But what can we do? The past is past. We can't undo it.
Neither can I.
You can accept our repentance, said Lillian, in a voice glassy with caution. I have nothing to gain from you now. I only want you to know that whatever I've done it because I loved you.
He turned away without answering.
Henry, cried his mother, what's happened to you? What's changed you like that? You don't seem to be human anymore. You keep pressing us for answers when we haven't any answers to give. You keep beating us with logic. What's logic at a time like this? What's logic when people are suffering? We can't help it, cried Philip. We're at your mercy, said Lillian.
They were throwing their pleas at a face that could not be reached. They did not know, and their panic was the last of their struggle to escape the knowledge that his merciless sense of justice, which had been their only hold on him, which had made him take any punishment and give them the benefit of every doubt, was now turned against them, that the same force that had made him tolerant was now the force that made him ruthless, that the justice which would forgive miles of innocent errors of knowledge would not forgive a single step taken in conscious evil.
Henry, don't you understand us? His mother was pleading.
I do, he said quietly. She looked away, avoiding the clarity of his eyes.
Don't you care what becomes of us?
I don't.
Aren't you human? Her voice grew shrill with anger. Aren't you capable of any love at all? It's your heart I'm trying to reach, not your mind. Love is not something to argue and reason and bargain about. It's something to give. To feel. Oh, God, Henry, can't you feel without thinking?
I never have.
In a moment her voice came back, low and droning. We're not as smart as you are, not as strong. If we've sinned and blundered, it's because we're helpless. We need you. You're all we've got. And we're losing you. And we're afraid. These are terrible times, and getting worse. People are scared to death, scared and blind and not knowing what to do. How are we to cope with it if you leave us? We're small and weak, and we'll be swept like driftwood in that terror that's running loose in the world. Maybe we had our share of guilt for it. Maybe we helped to bring it about, not knowing any better. But what's done is done, and we can't stop it now. If you abandon us, we're lost. If you give up and vanish like all those men who... It was not a sound that stopped her. It was only a movement of his eyebrows, the brief, swift movement of a checkmark. Then they saw him smile. The nature of the smile was the most terrifying of answers. So that's what you're afraid of, he said slowly. You can't quit, his mother screamed in blind panic. You can't quit now. You could have last year, but not now. Not today. You can't turn deserter, because now they take it out on your family. They'll leave us penniless. They'll seize everything. They'll leave us to starve. They'll... Keep still, cried Lillian, more adept than the others at reading danger signs in Reardon's face. His face held the remnant of a smile, and they knew that he was not seeing them any longer, but it was not in their power to know why his smile now seemed to hold pain and an almost wistful longing, or why he was looking across the room at the niche of the farthest window. He was seeing a finely sculptured face held composed under the lashing of his insults. He was hearing a voice that had said to him quietly here, in this room, It is against the sin of forgiveness that I wanted to warn you. You who had known it then, he thought. But he did not finish the sentence in his mind. He let it end in the bitter twist of his smile, because he knew what he had been about to think. You who had known it then, forgive me. There it was, he thought, looking at his family. The nature of their pleas for mercy. The logic of those feelings they so righteously proclaimed as non-logical. There was the simple, brutal essence of all men who speak of being able to feel without thought and of placing mercy over justice. They had known what to fear. They had grasped and named, before he had, the only way of deliverance left open to him. They had understood the hopelessness of his industrial position, the futility of his struggle, the impossible burdens descending to crush him. They had known that in reason, in justice, in self-preservation, his only course was to drop it all and run. Yet they wanted to hold him, to keep him in the sacrificial furnace, to make him let them devour the last of him in the name of mercy, forgiveness, and brother cannibal love. If you still want me to explain it, Mother, he said very quietly, if you're still hoping that I won't be cruel enough to name what you're pretending not to know, then here's what's wrong with your idea of forgiveness. You regret that you've hurt me, and, as your atonement for it, you ask that I offer myself to total immolation. Logic, she screamed. There you go again with your damn logic. It's pity that we need. Pity, not logic. He rose to his feet. Wait. Don't go. Henry, don't abandon us. Don't sentence us to perish. Whatever we are, we're human. We want to live. Why, no. He started in quiet astonishment and ended in quiet horror as the thought struck him fully. I don't think you do. If you did, you would have known how to value me. As if in silent proof and answer, Philip's face went slowly into an expression intended as a smile of amusement, yet holding nothing but fear and malice.
You won't be able to quit and run away, said Philip. You can't run away without money. It seemed to strike its goal. Reardon stopped short, then chuckled. Thanks, Philip, he said. Huh? Philip gave a nervous jerk of bewilderment. So that's the purpose of the attachment order. That's what your friends are afraid of. I knew they were getting set to spring something on me today. I didn't know that the attachment was their idea of cutting off escape. He turned incredulously to look at his mother. And that's why you had to see me today, before the conference in New York.
Mother didn't know it, cried Philip, then caught himself and cried louder. I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't said anything. I haven't said it.
His fear now seemed to have some much less mystic and much more practical quality. Don't worry, you poor little louse. I won't tell them that you've told me anything. And if you were trying...
He did not finish. He looked at the three faces before him, and a sudden smile ended his sentence. A smile of weariness, of pity, of incredulous revulsion. He was seeing the final contradiction, the grotesque absurdity at the end of the irrationalist's game. The men in Washington had hoped to hold him by prompting these three to try for the role of hostages.
You think you're so good, don't you?
It was a sudden cry, and it came from Lillian. She had leaped to her feet to bar his exit. Her face was distorted, as he had seen it once before, on that morning when she had learned the name of his mistress.
You're so good. You're so proud of yourself. Well, I have something to tell you.
She looked as if she had not believed until this moment that her game was lost. The sight of her face struck him like a last shred completing a circuit, and in sudden clarity he knew what her game had been and why she had married him. If to choose a person as the constant center of one's concern, as the focus of one's view of life, was to love, he thought, then it was true that she loved him. But if to him love was a celebration of one's self and of existence, then to the self-haters and life-haters, the pursuit of destruction was the only form and equivalent of love. It was for the best of his virtues that Lillian had chosen him, for his strength, his confidence, his pride. She had chosen him as one chooses an object of love, as the symbol of man's living power. But the destruction of that power had been her goal. He saw them as they had been at their first meeting. He, the man of violent energy and passionate ambition, the man of achievement, lighted by the flame of his success and flung into the midst of those pretentious ashes who called themselves an intellectual elite, the burned-out remnants of undigested culture, feeding on the afterglow of the minds of others, offering their denial of the mind as their only claim to distinction, and a craving to control the world as their only lust. She, the woman hanger-on of that elite, wearing their shop-worn sneer as her answer to the universe, holding impotence as superiority and emptiness as virtue. He, unaware of their hatred, innocently scornful of their posturing fraud. She, seeing him as the danger to their world, as a threat, as a challenge, as a reproach. The lust that drives others to enslave an empire had become, in her limits, a passion for power over him. She had set out to break him, as if, unable to equal his virtue, she could surpass it by destroying it, as if the measure of his greatness would thus become the measure of hers, as if, he thought with a shudder, as if the vandal who smashed a statue were greater than the artist who had made it. As if the murderer who killed the child were greater than the mother who had given it birth. He remembered her hammering derision of his work, his mills, his medal, his success. He remembered her desire to see him drunk just once, her attempts to push him into infidelity, her pleasure at the thought that he had fallen to the level of some sordid romance, her terror on discovering that that romance had been an attainment, not a degradation. Her line of attack, which he had found so baffling, had been constant and clear. It was his self-esteem she had sought to destroy, knowing that a man who surrenders his value is at the mercy of anyone's will. It was his moral purity she had struggled to breach. It was his confident rectitude she had wanted to shatter by means of the poison of guilt. As if, were he to collapse, his depravity would give her